This is a slightly different security presentation than I think most of the other topics of conversation throughout the day. So my company, New Knowledge, we focus on something called disinformation defense. We protect information integrity. So it's been a kind of a hot topic of conversation over the past year or so. And in fact, misinformation was the word of the year by dictionary.com. And when one of my co-founders and I used to do this type of work for the State Department when it was a counterterrorism problem back in 2015, we used to really fret about this, like how will we ever convince the public that they need to be concerned about people like weaponizing social media to manipulate public conversation? This is such a heady, like weird topic, nobody's ever gonna get it. And we used to joke that like one day, you know, like if it, we'll know that it's really stuck when somebody makes like a sitcom plot about it. Like a sitcom plot about political disinformation, like that'll be hysterical. And of course, that was a joke. The whole point was that like we didn't believe it was ever possible for the public to fully understand this problem. And then a few weeks ago, Saturday Night Live did a sketch about like disinformation on Facebook after one of the revelations about, you know, whatever Sheryl Sandberg or Mark Zuckerberg had done some like horrible thing to silence critics in the aftermath of, you know, Russian disinformation in 2016. And we thought, all right, we've made it. This is familiar to everybody by now. But I think the question we need to ask is, is why? I don't think people sometimes fully appreciate the scale of the problem or like why it's so possible or why it's so meaningful. Because I think, you know, people look at the 2016 elections as being kind of an inciting incident for this problem, you know, Russian disinformation in our political discourse. But in fact, it's a pretty old problem. I mean, my colleagues and I were focused on this when we were like nerds amongst nerds amongst nerds amongst nerds, like caring about how some terrorist group was manipulating Twitter with a lot of like social media bots and black hat marketing techniques. And people wonder if the election was the inciting incident, but for me, why this is so popular and prominent now, like why this is such a large topic of conversation, the real thing that's changed is that most people get most of their information on social media. That's what's changed. So whatever like kind of naive amateur trolling tactics we used to do now actually have a significant impact on the broader population because of the scale of the problem. This is not new. People are more than happy to share information when it's salacious rather than if it's true. I'm sure everybody's seen the screenshots of tweets that get, you know, 50,000 retweets, and then right underneath it there's the correction because somebody made a mistake, and that gets like 50 retweets because who cares? It's just amplified by social media. But I think this is the big thing for the folks in this room. You know, we've spent a couple decades now creating some type of like emotional, cultural relationship with all of our customers. Like our brands almost, you know, have an identity, they have a personality, and everybody has a relationship with them. And it is almost like ideological, the way that we associate with one brand or another. But that's exactly what's being exploited when we weaponize social media to drive a wedge between users and the thing that they care about, whatever that is. Democracy, political parties, major sports franchises. And so here we are. We're now at a stage where, like, if you can make a trend, you can make it true. So now social media popularity basically means that something is factual. We believe that it's more likely to be true if we see it a lot of times and a lot of people seem to agree with it by giving it some social stamp of approval, which is a big problem if you can invent social approval or if you can invent social consensus because you run a, you know, a farm of 50,000 Twitter accounts, or you can rent a network of Instagram accounts and give yourself 100,000 likes or regrams or whatever in the space of 30 minutes. And then, of course, Russia. So state actors. So this is actually how we most recently got into the problem. Apologies for the meme. So I said I got into this from a counterterrorism perspective, and then in 2016 we started looking into the problem because terrorists are, of course, scary and very problematic, but also for most of us here in the United States, the likelihood that we're going to be harmed by a terrorist attack is very small. The likelihood that we will be harmed in a domestic terrorist attack is actually very, well, relatively speaking, much more likely. And so I started looking into U.S. domestic extremism on social media, and then, as noted, they responded. So the way that we did this was by looking at like hyper-polarized language, language that really like drove a wedge in between mainstream communities and extremist communities. And this is getting back to a point in a minute, I promise. But so the way that like normal people, and the way that we did it was like measuring the difference between regular language and extremist language, language that was really polarizing and could drive a wedge in between different communities. And so it turns out that regular people use the word Jewish like every other word that denotes somebody's religion. This was our kind of big discovery. So you talk about a Jewish person, a Muslim person, a Christian person, like it's basically the same structure. Your language is inherently similar. So from context, we can learn like the regular meaning of the word Jewish-ish. We know it's about religion. But then if you go look at extremist language on social media, language that's amplified and produced and artificially disseminated by actors like Russia and domestic trolling organizations and whatever, it turns out that their use of the word Jewish is mathematically substantively different. It's very different, in fact. If you are a white nationalist account, or you know, trying to appear to be a white nationalist account as operated by somebody sitting in like an IRA troll farm in an office building in St. Petersburg, this is how you use the word Jewish. For you, it's not a religious descriptor, it's actually an epithet. So we can measure this difference. We basically can measure the difference between Russian trolling language, pretending to be Americans who have sort of extremist views, and regular Americans who don't use language in this way. So if you can't read it in the back, basically, if in normal language the word Jewish is synonymous to the word Muslim or Christian, in extremist language the word Jewish is synonymous to communist and homosexual, which is about as white nationalist as it gets. But so what we really wanted to understand is how we could take these pockets of language, these kind of like hyperactive, hyper-extreme, weaponized social media networks, and how does that language start to infect the broader population? Are they actually having any impact? And so we looked at the way that mainstream language changed after this targeted, kind of weaponized extremist language was injected into the conversation by force. So we found, you know, tens of thousands of Facebook accounts, hundreds of thousands of Twitter accounts, like just massive social media networks on multiple channels throughout 2016 that were trying to inject this language into the conversation, this extremist language. And if you see, kind of right around April 2016, like something dramatic changed. Basically, the way that the mainstream started to use language, like Jewish, for example, started to look more and more and more and more like these like weaponized networks, these extremist, sort of like purposefully extremist communities that we'd identified as being associated with Russia and other domestic domestic extremist groups. So that's on Twitter. So Twitter, something suddenly changed us right around April 2016. We did the same thing on Facebook. There's a huge change in the way that the public uses this language, again, right around April 2016. We looked at the timing of when language on various social media platforms started to change in concert. So this was Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, the comments section of your favorite website, whatever. And it usually that language never overlaps. Usually that language is distinct and unique. But right around April 2016, there was like this collapse of the internet and everybody started talking in the same way, kind of adopting this extremist rhetoric, or so it seemed. And then we looked at all of the accounts that were driving that new language. And we looked at when they were created relative to when they started posting content on the internet. And it turns out that they were a bunch of sleeper accounts that had been sitting around sometimes since as early as 2009, doing absolutely nothing, and then suddenly all sprang to life, surprise, right in April of 2016. And we all know what happened with the 2016 elections, but I think more recently, still we're kind of suffering the consequences of this type of activity. This is the guy who walked into the synagogue in Pittsburgh, I think, and committed an act of terrorism just earlier this year. And this is a researcher called Jonathan Albright who dug into all of his social media content. And he basically read every single post that this guy had put up on Facebook from 2014 onward. And what he discovered was that all of a sudden, around April 2016, this guy's
see, like, suddenly changed. He did an about face. He was talking about random things like, you know, cars, women, real estate, bodybuilding. And then right after that, he started obsessing about, like, posting anti-Semitic rants right around the same time that we'd seen this kind of dramatic change in people's language years before. So it's having a pretty significant impact on, you know, it can have a significant impact on how people talk online and how they behave. So this is the basic, sort of the primer for this type of intentional manipulation of public conversation and ultimately of people's behavior. So what we find is that sometimes in like quasi-mainstream spaces like Reddit, you know, the subreddits with the dankest memes, places like 4chan, 8chan, private Discord channels, private Facebook groups, basically some place that is not, that's opaque or not visible to mainstream social media platforms. People hang out in those spaces. They commit to a campaign, so they'll brainstorm. They'll basically like produce content and workshop it together. They'll come up with phrases, hashtags, memes, kind of workshop it together as a small group, find something that they think is going to be successful, find something that might actually further their ideological agenda. They get together, they build the content, they create a campaign, and then ideally they push that campaign on mainstream social media, because on mainstream social media, that's where all of the social media influencers are. So it used to be that it was pretty easy to force something to trend on a mainstream platform so you could push your content into the mainstream just with platform mechanics. You can kind of do that now, it's a little bit more difficult, and so now they target social media influencers with content that they think that influencer is likely to launder. So somebody on the political periphery, somebody who maybe has a small social media audience, like 500,000 or a million followers on whatever platform, if you can convince that person that his or her community is interested in the content you're producing, they're more likely to share it with their followers because they think it gives them legitimacy. They don't know that they're being gamed. Okay. So what? I mean, the end of democracy, it's very bad. That seems like a problem that's too big for this, you know, group to solve here in this room. We can work on it. But I think, you know, for those of us who are focused on a piece of the problem, I think that there's a role to play for private companies, not just because, you know, we all believe in democracy, but also because brands are increasingly caught in the crosshairs for this type of activity. So in addition to this type of activity around political discourse, what we see often is that, again, because this content is like designed to be polarizing, it's designed to sort of create a wedge between different communities based on their ideology, that we see brands that either intentionally took a political position or got forced to take a political position by circumstances beyond their control, that now they are part of this discussion. They might end up being targeted by the same tools and tactics. Not to pick on the NFL, but they've had the same thing happen. Of course, so I'm sure that the NFL wishes this problem was never their own to begin with, so everybody knows the story in case you don't follow football or read the news ever. There were a bunch of players last season who decided to kneel during the national anthem as a protest, and that protest resulted in a strong backlash. Prior to the much more public discussion, where everybody, multiple politicians, the president himself decided to weigh in on this controversy, there was a coordinated trolling campaign that was launched on 4chan. If you don't know what 4chan is, good for you, steer clear of it. don't open it at work. Careful about Googling it. But it's an anonymous web forum. Anything goes. There's no usernames, there's no content ultimately gets destroyed. It's archived, but for the most part, it's a kind of a temporal, ephemeral, anonymous web forum where these types of campaigns are easy to coordinate because nobody knows who you are on the internet. And so what often happens is in places like this, somebody will pick up on this narrative. Again, a campaign will be designed. In this case, that coordinated trolling effect that I talked about before, where a domestic group will workshop content, they'll push it to a mainstream platform and try and get lift, got an added boost, because when it comes to things like race, state actors that are interested in sowing division amongst Americans on divisive social issues are more than happy to amplify that content, because then they don't have to produce it themselves. It turns out it's really difficult to get to know a culture so well that you can produce content that will effectively manipulate people who live in that culture. So if I'm some guy sitting in my office in St. Petersburg, like if you could imagine the reverse, like how would you design a meme that would make people riot in the streets of St. Petersburg? Whoa, that sounds like a lot of time and effort and expense. It would be way better to find people who are already producing that content and just amplify it with the resources that you have at your disposal. So again, this is where brands get caught in the crosshairs. A network of Russian-linked social media accounts across multiple platforms that we've been monitoring for years started to amplify the sort of take a knee hashtag, dump the NFL, stand for the flag, things that were associated with people in opposition to the campaign that the players were conducting on the field. And then, of course, as that campaign was more successful, the initial trolling group, who had no idea that they were being amplified by a Russian network, felt, this is fantastic, everything that we do about the NFL is super successful, so let's try other things. And then the campaign iterated, and of course they've basically been encouraged to continue undermining the NFL brand by sort of no fault of the NFL's. So this is a little bit more background on the campaign. Again, you know, there was sort of a mass adoption. I think most people are probably familiar with this campaign and the backlash. At this point, again, lots of amplification of hashtags and the topics of the campaign by, again, the kind of a network of Russian-linked social media accounts. And these have pretty significant reach. So we're talking about like tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, in some cases, millions of social media interactions that are generated more or less from scratch, artificially and by design. And this is all prior to more kind of high-profile political figures. As you can see, like at some point, people who are people with like for whom this is like ideologically consistent with the way that they want to move through the world, Donald Trump Jr. and, like I said before, ultimately the president weighed in on this. I think it's sort of it's a situation where like folks like in this scenario, Donald Trump Jr. has ultimately been victimized by people who wanted to make him their parrot, and you know they were successful. So this is a campaign that then the community iterated on. 4chan, having had such a massive success with the campaign that they launched the first time, like if you can work your way up all the way and put words in the president's mouth, I'd say that's a pretty big success. And so they, you know, started coming up with other campaigns that they thought would be similarly socially divisive. These were ultimately less successful, probably because like transgender rights are not kind of on the menu. They're not useful to Russian disinformation networks at the moment. They tend to focus on other things, race usually, and immigration. Okay, something a little bit closer to home, perhaps. And these are, I mean, these are fairly common. I think that's sort of the big takeaway here. Definitely for high-profile consumer brands, like the NFL, obviously, Netflix, other film studios. We try not to put anybody on the slide who's a customer for obvious reasons. But it's not just these large companies. We see it a lot in any industry that's impacted by public opinion, or any industry that is unfortunate enough to get caught up in some type of cultural moment. The oil and gas industry has long suffered disinformation campaigns that are state-sponsored, because they compete with kind of geopolitical rivals, or they compete with organizations in countries that have nationalized oil and gas production and also have highly developed information warfare capabilities. So companies or organizations in Iran and Saudi Arabia and Russia. Disinformation against an oil and gas company is a little bit different. It might be that they manipulate public opinion, which ultimately changes the perception of the problem or how much people care about the problem in the eyes of lawmakers, who then legislate against the oil and gas companies, which is a normal thing to do. Policymakers should, you know, make policy, but they should, you know, from our point of view, they should be able to do that having not been manipulated by a large network of a disinformation network purporting to represent public opinion in the United States. Anyway, so back to Netflix. So this follows a similar pattern. We saw a campaign of coordination after Susan Rice was appointed to the Netflix board. So again, anonymous trolling groups launched a campaign, and I think this is an important thing to call out. So like commentary about one social issue or another, or the actions of Netflix or any other film studio or any major brand are common and totally acceptable. Of course, like some people will agree and disagree with Susan Rice sitting on the board of any major company, who cares? But the difference here is that there's a clear call to action where this community isn't just complaining about it, isn't just saying, you know, I hate Susan Rice and her politics. They're saying, hey, because of this, we are going to take a specific action. We're going to go after Netflix. We're going to use these hashtags, and we're going to try and create a boycott campaign so people suspend their accounts or drop their Netflix accounts and move to some other service. We're going to penalize Netflix for their action, and we're going to do it in a coordinated, intentional way. And that's ultimately the difference that we're looking for. So here was a clear call to action. After the clear call to action, there was a spike in social media activity, not just in kind of social media automation that promoted the boycott Netflix hashtag, but where the accounts were cleverly, I think, piggybacking on top of hashtags that they thought would be resonant with kind of like-minded social media users. And so in this case, you know, other kind of popular conservative hashtags, they would use that hashtag and then drop in the boycott Netflix hashtag in order to like force tweets into other people's feeds so that they would get introduced to this idea, which I was kind of surprised still worked, to be honest. Like that was the type of thing that ISIS used to do in 2015. And I guess Twitter's still working on that one. So anyway, automated distribution. And then we saw the same thing again. So because this was a political topic, because Susan Rice is a public figure, this is another example of where we saw the boycott Netflix hashtag and that conversation amplified by the Russian network that we were monitoring. And so I can't remember why they were also talking about Ecuador when this campaign was going on, but sort of almost immediately after that campaign was launched on 4chan, and we saw the automation on mainstream social media, we saw these Russian networks amplifying, again, conversations about Susan Rice and Netflix, and then it went all the way up to RT. If you're not familiar with RT, also congratulations. It's Russia Today. It's a kind of a Breitbart-y insurgent publication that is a kind of a Russian propaganda outlet. Yeah, and Julian Assange. Popular topic with Russia, I would have no idea why. Julian Assange fans? Teach their own? And so anyway, ultimately the reason that we did this outside of government is because in addition to it being a national security problem, it's an information ecosystem problem. I think we realize that this is something that doesn't just impact voters, it doesn't just impact elections or democracies, it impacts, you know, public discourse writ large, and all of the organizations that have a say in that, or should have a say in that. And so in order to partner with the social media platforms, in order to partner with private companies, and then of course national security as well, we knew that we needed to develop a technology that would be able to detect these types of campaigns in real time, collect data from wherever we felt like we needed to collect it. Anybody with a national security background knows that that's kind of a challenge, depending on what your authorities are. But ultimately get to this underlying idea that I think is often lost in this conversation about disinformation, because it started mostly being a conversation about quote-unquote fake news, is that, as you can tell through a lot of these examples, what we're ultimately looking for are distribution patterns. And this is where it's actually a lot more like a cybersecurity problem than it is like a crisis PR problem or like some other kind of like public affairs approach, social intelligence, something like that. The difference between people who are legitimately upset about something or a viral movement or a viral conversation or an online protest or whatever and this type of intentional activity that's designed to manipulate public discussion and influence people's behavior is intent. And the distribution patterns are fundamentally different. And so if we can reliably identify with signals intelligence these types of coordinated activity across multiple social media platforms, then we can understand how these campaigns are conducted, who's doing it, who they're targeting, and then ultimately work our way back, ideally, to the spaces where those campaigns are coordinated so that we can make the platforms aware that they're about to happen. The social media platforms have sort of dramatically changed their opinion over the past 12 to 18 months, maybe with the threat of legislation, hard to say. They have become much more sophisticated about the way that they implement their policies. So this type of inauthentic coordinated behavior is no longer allowed. The public is also much smarter about this type of activity. So informing them that a disinformation campaign is underway is possible now in a way that it wasn't before. So if you can learn about it immediately as it begins to happen or before it happens, or identify networks of accounts that are consistently engaging in this type of activity over time, you can have a pretty significant impact on the problem. That is an animated transition that I was not expecting. I'd just like to call out that I did not do that. But again, ultimately, like the broader problem here is that we are eroding trust in the systems that we've established for sharing information with one another. So while there's a short-term problem every time, you know, the brand that you represent takes a hit in the news, you're probably going to survive any given news cycle. But what you're not going to survive is the erosion of brand affinity over the course of months or over the course of years. And what we're not going to survive, frankly, as a democracy, is not being able to communicate authentically with each other, because nothing is to be believed. And if you can't believe anything, or everybody believes what they want, then I think we're going to have a really difficult time getting to some kind of a shared understanding about how we want to run society. So I have 2 minutes and 55 seconds left. If anybody has any questions or comments, I'd love to chat about it.
Questions?
I'll also be around.
Hold on 1 second, comments. Wait for the microphone.
Okay.
Alicia.
First of all, that was fascinating. One quick question I was thinking about is that I know what's become popular is the fact that when people are having these different contests, they need lots of votes on something, right, on Facebook. And what I learned about was the fact that they'll have these are fake people, right, with fake accounts doing all these votes. And so what the extension that I was thinking about, and I wonder if you have any comments on, is that, so if you imagine companies, you know, a lot of times they come up with their marketing strategy based on likes, or also even if you think of our government, where a particular person in office is looking at the whole discourse of what people in their particular area thinks about a particular thing, and that could all be fake as well. So,
I think. That's a thing that almost all of our customers are concerned about, because they are making operational decisions about, you know, where to spend marketing dollars, for example, or like what corporate policies might need to change based on either public enthusiasm, which is sometimes manufactured, or, you know, public disgust. And most of the tools that we've built to understand social conversation are mostly based, even when they're very sophisticated, they rely on, inherently on volume. And volume is the kind of easiest thing to manufacture. So I agree. I mean, I think ultimately one of the primary values of this, even before you get to more complex things like remediation, is just knowing like what's actual, what's real and what's not, in terms of how, because by the time it surfaces to a human, you know, it's really difficult to tell.
Excellent. Thank you. Your question over here.
Real quick, and I probably don't want to know the answer, but the triggering event in April 2016?
Oh, that was when the IRA, the Internet Research Agency, the kind of the disinformation arm of Russian intelligence, pivoted to focus on the 2016 elections exclusively. Not exclusively, but like there were a bunch of accounts that they'd been... I should pause before answering that question as fully as I was about to for like 2 or 3 weeks. yeah.
We'll take that. That was that was great. Any other questions?
Sorry.
Ladies and gentlemen? Oh, yeah, Linda, you got one here?
Okay, so last week I saw a presentation on deepfakes, and now after this I'm really depressed. So about the state of our democracy. So do you have anything you can say about the research that's being done to help automatically identify deepfakes?
Yeah, that's a really fascinating arms race, I think. my opinion there is that it will probably always be neck and neck with manufactured content. So like manufactured images, things that are basically created from nothing. I would argue that the real thing, the thing that will, like the paradigm shift that will be really difficult, is when language generation, content generation, like images or even videos, gets more personalized. So the kind of like hyper-targeting plus improvements in content generation, those two things combined means that, you know, I could spearfish all of you at once without trying. You know, because I would just set loose something that would learn your behaviors, learn your preferences, understand your style of speaking, understand the content that you're most likely to engage with, and manufacture something just for you. So I'm not trying to disseminate it on a broad scale, which sort of trips a lot of wires, and then means that, like, well, that image should be dissected as being sort of fake or not fake, if that makes sense. So I guess I think that that will be an ongoing problem, but kind of in the way that like network defense for cybersecurity is an ongoing problem, where adversaries always get a little bit better at uncovering vulnerabilities in a network, we get always better at like patching them and detecting their tactics. And I think in terms of like content generation, whole kind of whole cloth like that, like deepfakes will probably be similar to that problem.
Well, we're all used to also CAPTCHAs, right? To right. find out, right? Like, couldn't they put a CAPTCHA on in terms of, you know, to assume that this is a human? So anyway, sorry, I didn't really interrupt.
Yeah, yeah.
We have one more question right over here, John.
I mean, you can break CAPTCHAs. I'm just, not that I would ever.
Yeah, so that's where I was going to go. But yes, thank you for being here, because this is fascinating and relevant. But so you've talked a little bit about how you could early on identify what may be happening to clients and potentially other social media players. But do you have any thoughts or suggestions or comments about what then might be done? Because identifying the problem is the beginning, but then what do you do about it?
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, it's sort of multi-tiered. I think it's kind of like the point of no return is a campaign was launched on mainstream social media and then real people started adopting it. Like after it's kind of hopped the tracks, it's like, well, you know, now it's a topic of public conversation. You kind of can't put that cat back in the bag. But I think everything prior to that, it's possible to have an impact. Engaging with the social media platforms and giving them advanced warning that there's a campaign that's planned to launch on their platform, even if they don't, even if they're not comfortable like taking down accounts or suspending accounts, depending on kind of where it sits in their policy or what social media platform it is, usually they'll depress content that they know is manipulative because it was coordinated someplace else. So you can reduce the number of real people that engage with it and kind of leave the bad actors kind of communicating amongst themselves, which I think is important, or at least useful in the short term. I think identifying networks that are consistently engaging in this behavior over time means that you can make it more expensive to rebuild the infrastructure, A, because you've identified new sets of tactics that you can provide to the platforms as partners, and B, if it's like it's a lot more difficult to generate accounts from scratch than it used to be, which is kind of one of the primary weapons here. So it used to be that you could generate social media accounts programmatically, like Facebook and Twitter accounts. You could have as many as you wanted. And you know, like anybody who's explored the marketplaces for buying accounts, or renting accounts or whatever, they used to be cheap. Twitter accounts were like a buck a throw. Like, you just buy as many as you wanted. And every time the platform would take them down, you could just generate more, and they were easy to purchase. A lot of that, that's where they've sort of focused and created the bottleneck, so that you can do damage to the kind of large actors who are trying to run these large, sophisticated campaigns by finding, like, large networks of accounts that they're operating. So it's there's like a, you know, a short-term and a medium-term solution, but I think the long-term stuff is outside the platform's control. It might be like changes in policy, changes in legislation, maybe partnering with national security agencies who have different authorities and can kind of go upstream and blow up some routers or whatever they're going to do. But yeah, I think in the short term, the platforms have to be partners in it, or the media, but...
Excellent. Well, Jonathan, we could sit here all day with Q&A. I mean, it's fascinating.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Third time's the charm. I mean, you knocked it out of the park again. So smart, so cool. I really appreciate that. Thank you.